And thank you for the invitation to come and speak here. It's a great place to be. It's actually nice to meet new people and see some old friends in the audience. Reminded me of the old days in Canada. So today I'm going to talk to you about ripples in space-time, searching for gravitational waves with LIGO. In fact, there's going to be a little subtitle. It's going to be "and Virgo" as we go through it, because there's actually another detector in the world that we now operate jointly with. And the talk is organized in a pretty simple way of really taking it at a very introductory level. So I'll start out by introducing you and reminding you what gravitational waves are, what their physical effects are, how you can generate them, and then move on to detection, and finally end up with a sampling of some results from the LIGO recent science runs, and sort of hopefully give you a flavor for where we are and where we're going. So to get started, hopefully most of you in the audience actually know this already, but we'll start at the basics. So general relativity, as you all know, came about with Einstein's field equations in 1915. And it's very simple field equations. We've got the curvature on the left. We've got the stress energy on the right. And the fundamental, then, one other hypothesis you have to build in if you want to talk about test particles is that the test bodies within the space-time move along geodesics of the space-time. You can actually also think of that as conservation of the stress energy tensor on the right-hand side. They really interchange in some respect. The other aspect of that is then that the geodesics, which are the geodesics of the space-time background, are determined by the curvature itself. And so in this little cartoon, which I believe dates back to Wheeler, you see that you've got this little dance between curvature on the left, matter on the right, where the curvature tells the matter how to move, and then the matter in the space-time tells the curvature space how to curve. So that's the essence of what goes on here in terms of general relativity. It is that the gravitational field is a manifestation of the curvature. Now, right away, pretty much, Einstein realized that the theory gave you gravitational waves. In fact, he did publish an early paper on it, but the 1918 paper is the one where he derives the gravitational waves properly. And the essence of it in somewhat modern notation is given here, and it's just a very simplified form of it. So we start out with our line element, just standard line element of space-time up the top there. Guess I'll make use of your hockey stick. So we've got our line element up here with the Minkowski metric appearing here in the first term, standard flat space metric, and some form of perturbation away from flat space appearing also in the metric. This perturbation is meant to be small, so we're going to treat it as something that is much less than one in some form of units, and I'm not going to get into any specific details or aspects of the technicalities. We're simply going to then plug this metric into our field equations, expand in powers of h, and arrive at the field equations linearized in h. When we do that, we end up with this set of equations here. So this is Einstein's equations again. You've got your stress energy on the right-hand side, as you did before in the equations you're fully familiar with. We also have a very nice wave operator, where we've got second derivatives with respect to time here, and the spatial gradient coming in here, acting on something that is basically a functional of the perturbation that appears up here in the metric, so a function of the metric perturbation. It's actually the trace reversed metric perturbation, so that's what this is here. You take out half the trace times the Minkowski metric, and you get the trace reverse perturbation. So you've got this very nice simple wave equation for the metric perturbation, according to Einstein's equations. We solve it in vacuum. So if we throw out the matter on the right-hand side, solve it in vacuum, you all know how to do this. It's really straightforward. And you end up with something that takes this form here. Actually, I should mention, despite the fact that I'm going to talk about gravitational wave astronomy, I am a theorist by training, and so I have set c equal to 1 here. So speed of light is unity. So when you solve this, you get the result for the trace reverse metric perturbation down here. It's got a constant amplitude coefficient out front, this tensor out front, times the exponential of I times some 4 vector inner product with the space-time coordinates. Okay, so this is nothing more than your standard wave equation, plane wave solution of the wave equation. and it is an approximate solution of the linearized Einstein, or it is an exact solution of linearized Einstein equations in vacuum. So Einstein's equations give us gravitational waves propagating modes. It gives us that these modes propagate at the speed of light. That's actually implicit in this definition here, as usual, and of course the fact that C is hidden up here. And then the last thing that you have to think about is what the effect is of having these oscillating solutions for the metric perturbation in this case. So if you go back up and just take a look, and again, I'm not going to go into the real nitty-gritty details of this, but you look at the line element, you know that this line element tells you about proper separation along between two points in the space that are separated by coordinates dx alpha and dx beta. And then if you've got an oscillating h alpha beta and you plug it in up there, you're going to get this gravitational waves changing the length of the space-time. Okay, so you're going to have change the length in the space-time. Now, the next issue then is how to generate gravitational waves. So you saw that in general we have the source on the right-hand side, the matter on the right-hand side. And I mentioned in my little cartoon, of course, curvature telling the matter how to move and matter telling the space-time how to curve. Well, of course, the key point here then is that if you take the material, and let me actually start, this is see if it works. Oh, yes, it does. Okay. So this is just your very simple-minded demonstration of some gravitational wave generation. The first thing is on the top plot, you see a point that is moving up and down on the screen. It's meant to represent some electrical charge moving up and down. It generates electromagnetic radiation. You all know this. In the context, then, of gravitational waves, you have a slightly more complicated situation where in this case, I'm indicating two pieces of matter, one going around the other. And when it does so, you get this time-changing profile of the matter as you look at it. Okay? So the lump of matter looks different as time goes by. And as a result, you get the generation of a gravitational wave that propagates out from that matter. So in the simplest sense, the bottom line is that when we have Einstein's equations, if you change the matter configuration, the gravitational field configuration will change, the curvature therefore will change, and it will propagate outwards from the source at the speed of light. And that's the essence of gravitational wave generation in that case. Once again, just to give a sort of a simple picture of the generation of gravitational waves and make sure you kind of get an idea of when you would expect to see them, fortunately, I left my good demo of this at home, but I can even do it with a tiny piece of chalk. Okay? So if you take a look at the piece of chalk, the first thing is you want to try and understand when will you get gravitational waves. And what I mentioned already here was that it's when you change the profile of the material as you look at it. Okay? So if I take the piece of chalk and I just have it pointing along the axis, the long axis of the piece of chalk, and I rotate it along that long axis, all of you, if you squint hard from the back, you can see that the profile doesn't change. And in that case, you don't generate any gravitational waves. Okay? It's an axisymmetric motion of the material. On the other hand, if I actually put the axis through the center of the piece of chalk and I rotate it like a bar, in that case, the profile of the gravitational wave as you see it is going to change, and you're going to get the generation of gravitational waves. So that's the essence of how you can decide whether or not you expect gravitational waves to occur and whether or not you expect to be able to generate them using some particular piece of matter. Now, the recipe for gravitational waves then is reasonably straightforward. Turns out, first thing we need is matter. That's pretty obvious. You need to get lots of it, and you need to squeeze it into as tight a space as possible. So you want to make it very, very dense, as high density as you possibly can. Second thing is, as I mentioned already with regard to the piece of chalk, the point is that if you have something that's a perfect sphere, no matter how you rotate it or try and move it around, you're not going to generate any gravitational waves, so you need to keep it lumpy. And the third thing then is that you need to move it very fast. Okay, so it turns out that the velocity comes into play in terms of what causes the generation of gravitational waves. So both the energy density and the velocity is going to be important, and so you need to move it around at the speed of light. If you do that, you'll generate strong gravitational waves. I mean, if I do this and shake my fist at poor old Chad in the back, then what happens is I generate some gravitational waves, but the actual power radiated from my fist is really, really small. But you still generate some. But in nature, we actually have a pretty good mechanism for generating gravitational waves. And it's basically stellar evolution. It gives us a mechanism to first of all, gather together the matter. So the early phase, we gather together matter that forms everyday stars, perhaps like our own, perhaps much more massive. Then over the course of a long period of time, depending on the mass of the star, you get an evolution of the star where it burns all its nuclear fuel. And eventually, what happens is it actually explodes in a supernova explosion. So in this context, what actually goes on is nature, just through gravitational attraction, pulls together a bunch of matter. Over time, it uses up its nuclear fuel, and eventually you have no way of supporting the material in the core, so you compress the material down further. And at some point, even though we don't really understand the mechanism, the star explodes in a supernova explosion, which may be have this non-symmetric behavior where you get some material moved around very quickly. You're certainly going to have a rapidly rotating object. The question is whether or not it's got enough asymmetry to generate strong gravitational waves. So this is the pretty easy stuff, and just gives you a feel for where you start with the detection of, with the generation of gravitational waves. The next question is, how do you go about seeing them? And of course, to do that, we've got to figure out what the effects are of the gravitational waves on material or objects as they pass by. So in the context of Einstein's theory of general relativity, it turns out that there are two polarizations. Those polarizations are usually discussed, it's quadrupole waves is what you expect. So they're usually discussed in terms of a ring of particles that are intended to float freely in some empty space. The gravitational waves are going to propagate into the blackboard, or into the whiteboard here. Okay? So the waves are going to come from the back of the room and propagate through the whiteboard. And the two polarization states then will change the nature of the ring of particles in certain ways, depending on which polarization is present. So the first polarization, the plus one, as we indicate on this, I've chosen the axis such that they're just up and down and back and across the page. And what happens is you get this stretching and squeezing in orthogonal directions. So at some point, it stretches in the vertical direction and squeezes simultaneously in the horizontal direction. And then it reverses and does the stretching in the horizontal and the squeezing in the vertical. And that's the basic effect of a gravitational wave. It stretches and squeezes in orthogonal directions in space-time as it propagates through. The second polarization is simple. It's offset by 45 degrees relative to the plus polarization. It's H cross. And you can see here it's doing the exact same thing, except you rotate your axes by 45 degrees. And you've got your stretching and your squeezing along orthogonal directions as that goes on. The key thing in this, in terms of actually getting ready to detect gravitational waves, is for us to take a look at what it is we can measure as a result of this. And it's pretty obvious what you're going to try and measure. You're going to try and measure this stretching and squeezing. In the old days, one of the effects that used to be thought about was take a big, huge piece of material, a bar of some kind, let the gravitational wave impact on it. It would then stretch it in certain directions, squeeze it in others, and would excite certain modes within the bar, and so ring the bar, essentially, as it passed. In modern times, what we've actually settled on is a different mechanism, and the mechanism is to track the change in length along orthogonal directions on the ring. So if I make this little cartoon here, which shows time moving to the right, and then I'm only looking at the plus polarization in this case, I've identified the center point of the ring as blue, the two pink dots represent orthogonal directions, and then over the course of a full cycle, what you get is, first of all, stretching along horizontal, simultaneous squeezing in the vertical, back to a circle, stretching in the opposite direction and squeezing in the opposite direction, and then back to a circle again. That's one full period. During this process, the important thing to notice is how big the maximum stretch is. So you start out with the distance between the center and one of these pink dots being L. And then at the maximal distortion, you've got this L plus delta L here. And the way that we talk about the strength of the gravitational wave is actually to talk about it in terms of how big this distortion is. So what we do is we actually use what's called strain. And strain is normally indicated by H. And it's given by the change in length at the maximum distortion divided by the original radius of the circle in this case. So change in length per unit length, strain, is going to be the critical thing that we use as we go through this talk to talk about the strength of gravitational waves. The one other thing to be aware of in this case, I don't dwell on it very much, but the strength of gravitational waves that when it propagates, where's my chalk gone, is so the gravitational waves will decay as 1 over the distance to the source. Okay, so if r is the distance to the source, the strength of the gravitational wave decays as 1 over the distance. Right? So that's going to be an important aspect as we go through and talk about the sensitivity of various detectors. So I've given you the theorist view of what a detector is. Now I'm going to give you the still theorist view, but with a little bit more reality turned in. And that is, this is the schematic of a detector. If I was a real theorist, the beam splitter would be turned the incorrect way. That's just a standard thing that theorists do. But in this case, what we have is we have a situation where you can think of the pink dots in the previous circle as corresponding to these test masses here and here. These are suspended mirrors. Okay, so they're mirrors. They're hung out of various suspensions and very carefully done. There is, in the simplest case, I'll ignore a bunch of stuff that's going on here. So ignore this inner test, these inner test masses, and ignore this recycling mirror. And just think of this beam splitter as being the center point, the blue point in the ring. Okay? Then as a gravitational wave passes, what it's going to do is it's going to compress along this direction, stretch along this direction. So it changes the length of the two arms in such a way that it'll cause an interference pattern to be set up. And back at the beam splitter, and you can pick off that interference pattern off here onto a photodiode. Okay. Now, there's a really nice little demonstration of this, which we're going to try and do, and it didn't work. Whoops. All right, let's try again. There's a really cool little demo of this on the American Museum of Natural History. This is basically a little model of an interferometer. Okay? It's got our laser off on the left. You can see it's all green here on the left and flashing away. We've got our beam splitter still here in the middle. We've got our photodetector again. We've got our end masses. So this is a mirror, and the X mirror in this case. We've got a Y mirror up here. We've got these inner test masses, which I'll mention a little bit more about in a moment, but for now I'll ignore them. And with this little demo, I should be able to turn on my laser. Let's see whether or not that works. Okay, there we go. All right. So we turn on our laser, and the laser sends light into along the two arms, and it bounces off the end mirrors and comes back towards the middle. As I say, I'm going to explain those the feature of this of the inner mirrors in a moment. The next thing is, if we get a distortion due to a gravitational wave, it'll cause the length of one of the X arms, say, to change. And as it does, you get this offset, you get an interference pattern, and you'll just barely begin to see the glow of the interfering light show up down here at the photodetector. Of course, I can then make it very, very strong, and you see the gravitation, you see the interference pattern set up really nicely down at the photodetector. Now, the one trick that is going on here is that I mentioned that you have these masses, these test masses also hanging in the middle in here. Okay? Well, it turns out that the type of interferometer that was able to be constructed initially that we thought would have the best sensitivity actually is not just a plain old Michelson interferometer that you know and love from your elementary physics courses. It's what's known as a Fabry-Perot interferometer. And the basic idea is that in that case, what you do is you set up mirrors at the end down here. but also near the beam splitter, you set up these secondary mirrors, and they allow light to pass into this region between the two mirrors, but not out if they're tuned just to have the right length so that the cavity is on resonance. And so the light inside of that arm bounces back and forth about 200 times in the LIGO detectors, which we'll talk about in a moment, and then eventually leaks out the end. And what happens when you actually distort make the arm length difference is you actually pull things off resonance and you cause some of the light to actually leak out these arms at the end, and so you get some interference at the photo detector. Okay? So this Fabry-Perot detector is the one that's actually been implemented, slightly more complex than our standard, what we think of as a Michelson interferometer. But still, it's basically the same concept. You interfere some very coherent light and cause yourself to have an interference pattern that you monitor. The interesting thing to think about is the LIGO design goals. LIGO design goals are such that they're going to be able to measure change in length per unit length of delta, that's delta L over L, of 10 to the minus 21. That by itself is not hugely amazing until you actually try and figure out what delta L is. And delta L is then 10 to the minus 21 times 4 times 10 to the 3 meters. So it's about 10 to the minus 18, he says, meters. Okay, so the change in length that actually gets measured by these things is going to be 10 to the minus 18 meters. Change in length is 10 to the minus 18 meters. So it's a very, very refined instrument and well able to achieve these sensitivities, it turns out. So what I want to do now is I want to move on to tell you a little bit away from the theory of these things and tell you just a tiny bit about the instruments themselves. I'm not the instrumental expert, so I'm not going to focus in on those particular things. In the United States, the instrument that we have is LIGO. It's Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. There are two sites associated with the observatory. The first one is in Hanford, Washington, up in the desert near the nuclear site. And the other one is down in Livingston, Louisiana, in the middle of a swamp. Okay. They're 3,000 kilometers apart, roughly 10 milliseconds for a gravitational wave propagating along the line joining the two things. And they really do exist at this point. There was a long time where we only used to talk about them. But this is a picture of the vacuum tanks inside of the Hanford site. So it's inside of this site up here. These vacuum tanks are housed in this station here in the middle. This corresponds to the blue dot in the circles that I had before. There's two arms, one stretching off in the distance here, one stretching off in the distance here. They're the orthogonal arms. And the end masses, the mirrors at the end of the arms, are located down here and also one way off here on the right. Okay. Yeah?
They're not aligned. The axes are off the line.
So in actual fact, they were chosen. They're actually oriented so that they're as close to aligned in the vertical direction as possible. And they were done that way. And then the secondary thing in terms of the orientation of the arms was just constrained by the location where they were being built. But they actually tried to get them almost identically aligned. But it turns out they're 10 degrees off, just based on the curvature of the Earth. One other thing, it's less important here right now, but there's one other thing. The long baseline, the two separate sites, was established just because you're trying to measure 10 to the minus 17 meters. 10 to the minus 17 meters is going to be susceptible to all sorts of stuff. And so you want to have two independent measurements that hopefully don't have correlated noise. And and the last thing that I wanted to mention was that up in Hanford, it turns out that what was constructed was two different instruments. One of them is a 4-kilometer instrument. So the arms that you see, these ones that are stretching off into the distance with the concrete covers over them, these arms are 4 kilometers long. But if you look carefully up in this image, you'll notice that the arm stretches off into the distance here, but just out here, there's a small little room, a building that you notice. And that is actually 2 kilometers along the arm. The instruments at Hanford, there was a 2 kilometer instrument in place as well. Basic idea being that gravitational wave will actually induce the same strain in both of them, but the local interference would actually cause them to respond differently, and so we'd be able to tell the difference between a real gravitational wave and some form of local distortion. Now, the picture of these instruments is reasonably simple at this point. You've got this just basic idea. It's nothing more than your standard textbook general relativity. But the actual instruments themselves have fairly complicated noise budget, where you have some limiting noise sources that cause you to be only able to detect gravitational waves in certain frequency bands. In the context of the LIGO detectors, the most important noise sources, although there are many others, the most important noise sources are first is the seismic one. So we've got seismic noise. It comes in at low frequencies. In the LIGO detectors, it turns out that it comes in at around 100 hertz. That's where it starts to really rise very, very quickly as frequency goes down. And it really is nothing more than transfer of vibrations into the S end masses, into any of the tables that mount all the various things through the suspensions. That's all it is. The second form of noise is photon shot noise, and this is a counting statistic problem. In order to get a good measurement, you kind of want to have lots and lots of photons. On the other hand, in order to be able to distinguish between when you have no interference pattern, you have an interference pattern, you want to actually have just a few. And so what happens is we get a photon counting noise that enters in at higher frequencies. As a result of the transfer function through the instrument, it actually rises with frequency. Okay? That's something that you don't necessarily expect. You expect photon noise to be just flat, but the instrumental transfer function causes it to rise at higher frequencies. The third type of noise that dominates in the intermediate regime between about 40 hertz and 100 hertz is this suspension thermal noise. This is just the standard Brownian motion of all the different pieces that make up the instrument that just lead to some fundamental vibrations and noise sources coming into play. So this is then the frequency band where we're interested in detecting gravitational waves. It starts somewhere around 40 hertz, goes up to a couple of kilohertz up here. If you take where the absolute best sensitivity is, it tends to be around 100 to 200 hertz. So what you need to do is you need to get a lot of material going around with a frequency around 100 hertz, so 100 times per second. So to do that, you really need some fairly extreme situations. Now, the progress towards gravitational wave detection has been actually a very, very long road. In fact, this only shows realistically one decade. It's the decade I happen to know well, because roughly speaking, I started somewhere here working in the field, and up to here is 2009. However, the field actually goes way, way back, first of all to the 60s, when Joe Weber was the first person to actually try and actually use these bar detectors to detect gravitational waves. Ray Weiss came up with the idea for the interferometric detector in the early 70s, so about 1971 was when he first wrote his notes on that. And it wasn't until 1989 that the LIGO proposal was funded, and it is now 20 years later when we actually really have these instruments and are able to do some science with them. It was a long road. It's worth just taking a quick look. In this particular case, what I've got indicated is the different stages in our progress towards making the instruments work. The inauguration, which I'll later refer to as kind of acceptance of the instruments, this was when the basic site was commissioned. The instruments were first put in place. It was about 1999. The first time we were able to get the instruments operating reasonably well was around 2000. 2002 for having one of the instruments operating properly. And our main science run, known as S5 to us, started in 2005. Started late in 2005, went for 2 years till the 30th of September 2007. Over the course of this period, the strain noise, right? Remember our target was somewhere around 10 to the minus 21. The strain noise went from 10 to the minus 17 down by an order of magnitude roughly every year until that last step where it took us a couple of years to get down by the final order of magnitude and down to the sensitivity that we were interested in. The units are slightly different than the 10 to the minus 21 here because there's a square root hertz unit on this, which is a detail that's not very important. The main point here is that we started out with something at 10 to the minus 17, and we ended up with instruments around 10 to the minus 23 in sensitivity. So I'll mention a little bit more. You'll notice I've mentioned this S6 start. So if you come down here on this plot, these are the different science runs we had. We had a 1 week run, 2 week run, a 1 month run, a week run, and then we had a 2 year run. This ended 2007. We just turned on into F6 in August, and the S6 run was with slightly enhanced instruments. So the actual detectors have been improved. It turns out that our sensitivity is not much better at the moment, so they're still working on that. But again, a reminder, it comes really hard to get the sensitivity.
So is there a future goal to keep that down even further, or
there is.
What's the optimum?
So the first thing is that we stay with the S6 one. The plan with the S6 was to get another factor of 2. It doesn't seem like much, but I'll talk about why that's really good later. It goes back to the 1 over R decay. And so the first plan was to get a factor of 2 for S6. We're going to hopefully get that. The real goal, however, is the advanced LIGO instruments. They're about 5 years away, and they'll come online with a factor of 10 improvement. So I want to change gears a little bit now, move away from the basics of GR and the basics of gravitational wave detection onto the science goals for LIGO and what we hope we'll be able to do over sometime between the next 5 and 10 years. I don't want to actually try and bet on when. It always takes longer than we actually expect. Nothing is easy in this business. So the first goal we have is pretty obvious. We actually really want to verify the existence of gravitational waves by direct observation, show that they really behave as we expect, and hopefully also see some signatures of black holes. There are basic ones, right? It's like that's what we'd really like to be able to do at our first line. After that, we move on and we get into a whole host of other things that we can in principle do. We can do some detailed tests of the properties of gravitational waves, including checking that they actually propagate at the speed of light, checking that there are only 2 polarizations, understanding their strength, probing whether or not the graviton has a mass. It turns out that actually one of the better experiments that we could do with LIGO is that one. It's kind of a fun one. We should be able to probe strong field gravity around black holes, maybe also in the early universe. That's a little bit more hopeful, I would say, rather than actually likely. We definitely should be able to learn things about the neutron star equations of state. That's something that we're really beginning to get a hold on how we could do it. And then finally, the last thing to recognize is that what we hope to do is actually build an observatory. It's going to be an observatory that uses gravitational waves to actually look at the universe and begin to do routine astronomical observations. So the ultimate goal of order, the 2015 timeframe, is to actually be doing routine astronomy where we interface with all kinds of other astronomers. And I'll mention a little more about where we are with respect to that as at the end of the talk. Okay. So here we go, into our sources. This is, to some extent, where the theory that we know and love of gravitational physics meets this very practical effort of trying to detect gravitational waves. The cartoon on the right is meant to be a neutron star spiraling into a black hole. The neutron star got torn apart as it went in due to the tidal field. And what ends up happening at the end, we hope, maybe that there's emission of a gamma ray. But we also know for sure that during that phase where it was going around and falling into the black hole, gravitational waves are emitted. The targets for LIGO are black holes, neutron stars, and black hole neutron star pairs. So you just want to get 2 of these objects going around each other in a binary system. The mass range is really important. Remember, I told you our best sensitivity is at 150 hertz or so. This, it turns out, is what tells us what type of mass of binary system that we can detect. higher mass binaries emit gravitational waves at lower frequencies. Right? So as a result, the neutron stars, 1.4 solar mass objects, roughly, are good candidates, it turns out. These things generate gravitational waves in these binary systems that come right the way through our band as they get ready to merge. So they're going around each other for a very long time. And then eventually, the radiation that's emitted causes the orbit to shrink. And eventually, they come into the frequency band that the orbit is in, the frequency band that we're sensitive to. They emit the gravitational waves there, and hopefully we can detect them. The key point here is that we're sensitive only to the last few minutes of in-spiral merger. And last few minutes is a bit of a stretch. In our current searches, we're only sensitive to the last 30 seconds or so of the in-spiral merger of these objects. So we only get to see them just before they collide and merge into each other. In advanced LIGO, that's going to increase. It'll be about 30 minutes. So these objects are reasonably interesting. They're really nice, strong gravitational field cases, right? A neutron star is about the mass of the sun, compressed into about 10 kilometers. Okay, so it's a pretty compact object. Black holes, as you know, are pretty dense, and that's their good sources. So you've got barely a lot of material compressed into a small volume of space, and you've got them going around each other 100 times a second. They're moving pretty fast. So this goes back to our recipe. Compress matter into a dense region and also make them go fast. Once you do that, we get the gravitational waves and perhaps get other signatures. So one of the first results that I want to tell you about today is a result of an observation of GRB 070201. This was a gamma ray burst that was observed by the SWIFT satellite. Actually, it was observed by a whole host of other satellites as well. And it was a short duration gamma ray burst. This means, in the parlance of gamma ray burst observations, it means that it has had a duration of less than 1 second. The light curve for the photons in the gamma rays for this particular GRB are shown here. This duration is a little less than a second along this axis here. And the photon count jumps up right here, decays back down, and trails off pretty rapidly to essentially zero by the time it's down here. So this was detected by SWIFT, and very quickly then also seen by other gamma ray burst satellites and localized as best they could. The error box for the gamma ray burst is shown here, this yellow error box. And the interesting thing that was noted right away was that the error box actually overlapped with the Andromeda galaxy. This is M31. Okay. The overlap is pretty small, but you know we're stretched to try and find something, so we're willing to take anything we get. The interesting thing here is that what was not known at the time was what exactly caused it. Since they didn't get a full localization into the galaxy, and they didn't get optical counterparts, they couldn't actually determine whether this was a compact binary merging, or perhaps something else. The other model for short gamma ray bursts are neutron stars which accrete material and then have an explosive release at some point. So the interesting thing then was that for LIGO, this was our first opportunity to do some real astrophysics. So we searched the data around the time of this gamma ray burst to look for gravitational wave association. And in the end, we were able to rule out Andromeda. We were able to rule out a compact binary in the Andromeda galaxy with greater than 99% confidence. So we basically told the astronomers it's not a compact binary in the Andromeda galaxy. On the other hand, we were able then also to explore a range of masses, 1 to 3 solar mass for the first component of the binary, so a neutron star essentially, and or a neutron star or a black hole, up to 40 solar masses. And we were able to exclude that there was a compact binary progenitor for this source out to a distance of 3.5 megaparsecs at the 90% confidence level. Okay. So this result was actually useful then for the astronomers, because in the end, they were able to actually use it to make another observation of the spectrum of this GRB and basically infer other mechanisms by which they can say that they can try and dissociate between the binary progenitor for the gamma ray burst and other possible ways in which they're generated. So this was something that we were excited about. On the other hand, we actually had this one problem, which was we didn't detect any gravitational waves. So this was really unfortunate. Yes?
So that's very close for a gamma ray burst.
Yes.
Is it likely that it was just coincidental and it was from far away behind me?
So it's possible. There are actually plenty of galaxies out further away. In the end, it actually doesn't, it seems that probably isn't the case. It actually seems like it probably was an SGR in Andromeda that actually went off. So it's this other class that tends to be nearby than the short ones that are actually finding progenitors.
Stupid question. What is the probability if you take something happening in the sky that is happening within the reach of the Andromeda galaxy?
So that's a good question.
Of 1%?
Yeah, so let me, actually, yeah, so no, it's even worse than that. Let me, it's on the next slide. Let me give you at least a variant on the answer to that is on the next slide. Let me give it to you. So the other thing we do is we search for the gravitational wave signals from these binaries happening in the universe. And we have some estimates for how often they occur. The estimates are shown here on the left. The plot is really, it's really window dressing. I can tell you what the numbers are to give you a sense, but in the end, the really interesting numbers are the ones over here. The most likely rate for binary neutron stars that we have based on estimates from other observations is about 5 × 10⁻⁵ per year per L10. And L10 is 1.7 Milky Ways. Okay? Andromeda is somewhere around 2 Milky Ways, right? So the probability of actually getting a compact binary in Andromeda in our 2 years of observation taking the data is really small, okay, about 10⁻⁴ or so. So in fact, it was very unlikely, but there again, sometimes we get lucky, right? Supernova 1987A is a primary example, and we were not willing to give up on that perhaps happening. But turns out, no, we didn't actually get any gravitational waves that are plausible candidates. And so most likely this was much further away, as you'd expect, based on these priors. The other thing to note here is I want to just mention a couple of things. They'll be relevant later. The neutron star black hole range rate, we think, is about 1.5 × 10⁻⁶ per year per L10. So roughly speaking, about 1 per million years in the galaxy. And black hole binaries are somewhere around 2 × 10⁻⁷ per year. So one every, whatever it is, 10 million or 100 million years in the galaxy. So these are really rare within our galaxy. So one of the really critical things in terms of being able to get sensitive to these objects is we have to look much further out into the universe to be able to get lots and lots of galaxies. And our typical sensitivity at the moment, just to give you a rough number, is around 30. It depends exactly when you ask, but how far can we see binaries? So binary neutron stars, we tend to be able to see them to around between 30 and 40 megaparsecs. Okay. So it's reasonably far out. It's out past the Virgo cluster. We have a non-uniform beam pattern in our sensitivity, so we don't actually just get the full volume of a sphere out to that distance, but we actually do get a significant portion of the universe out to that distance. Yeah.
From the Virgo cluster, it's basically not very much you can get.
That's right. Yeah. So the Virgo cluster is the one we can get with our current detector. I'll say more about where we hope to go.
Maybe in a couple of years, be able to get it.
No, it's well, actually, a couple of years gets you there. So if you look at the numbers here, let me just give you, you can't read them, unfortunately. And this is an exclusion plot based on our searches for this type of object as a function of mass. So neutron stars actually are at this mass range down here. This is the rate per year per L10. And this is about 10⁻. Okay. You can compare that then to the neutron star rate here, which is somewhere around 10⁻⁴. So you need about 100 years, right? Okay. So the best way to get detections is not to wait and not keep looking, but to make the instrument better. That's our best approach. Okay. The thing here is, actually, I shouldn't dismiss these results completely. In fact, these results do start to impinge on the tail of our expectations for binary rates. The numbers I quoted here are the most likely rates based on the evidence we have so far. So these are the ones we think are most likely to be what the rates are. But there's a long tail extending up to higher rates and down to lower rates. So this starts to touch on those higher rates, just about. it's not very good for it, but it's getting in there. Chickens. Yes. Oh, no, I want. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, having been around for a while, I've seen these rates change all over the place in the 20 years you're talking about.
Yeah.
How secure, I mean, they used to be much higher.
So the
how secure
thing,
are they?
So I only know one way to measure that. I've been a proponent for not worrying about how accurate these are and always regarding them as uncertain by three orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
And one of the nice things is over the last about 4 years, there's been some work in collaboration to try and pin it down. I mean, it's been ongoing work for a long time. But there's been work to try and pin it down, and people were a few years ago saying, oh, well, no, those rates are too, they're wrong, you should redo it better. Well, after 3 years of work, they're the same as they were 3 years ago. So they're not changing. So the good news here is no new information is coming in on them. We actually don't know anything more than we really did about a decade ago. That's a decade ago.
It's a formation of neutron stars or the issue of dissociation of pairs?
It's, in fact, the most critical issue tends to be associated with the evolution of the binary, because what you can get is you can get various different effects. So during the formation process for the black hole or the neutron star in the binary system, you can get them actually ripped apart or together, depending on the exact the winds that come off the different objects as they're going through their evolutionary phases. You can cause things to separate or harden. The bottom line is there's lots of actual different things that can go on. It really is the evolution, though. It's the evolution in binaries. That's the important issue that we don't understand very well, because you can count supernovae in the universe.
Right.
So that's easy to do. So we can actually estimate the supernova rate, but we really don't know the transfer function to get down to the binary coalescence rate. Yeah.
So those rates, I guess, now are stabilizing, if I understand what you said. So does that mean advanced LIGO in 5 years will pull 30 to 40 into 3 to 4?
Yes, that's one of my punchlines, but yes.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. No, it's good. So yeah, that's right. So the good news on that is that we expect in advanced LIGO that these things will be somewhere around, let me use 50 as the order of magnitude, about 50 events per year detectable with advanced LIGO. Now, there's all kinds of caveats there. There's three orders of magnitude range, right? It could be a 10 times higher or 100 times lower. So things are pretty uncertain here. But the thing is, we really do expect it. And for these objects, I would say that compact binaries are the most likely source. They're our bread and butter source. They're the ones that I'd actually gamble on. I wouldn't gamble on pretty much anything else. Yes.
And it's just your volume's going up, so the numbers are going to get bigger.
The detectable, the number that we can detect.
Yeah, all right.
So
that's really right. Yeah.
I'm actually going to show a result. I'm going to skip a couple of slides because I'm running late on time, but I just picked out a couple of recent results, somewhat because they may be of interest here, just for fun. So a few years ago, there was a lot of excitement about the fact that, well, you know, in string theory, you can form cosmic strings, essentially, and there could be cosmic strings in the universe. And in particular, then, it was also realized that if you take a cosmic string in the universe and they form loops, then as they're wiggling around the universe, what can happen is they kind of crack like a whip. So you get a whip crack in them going on, and they come around and crack like this. And when they do, you get, again, fairly high density, right, because the mass per unit length is pretty high. And you get very fast motion as they crack. So it's just like cracking a whip. They just crack out, and you get very fast motion. So you've got high density, fast motion, gravitational waves are generated. So we actually have a result which was based on a search for gravitational waves from cosmic string cusps and kinks in the universe. It was published recently in PhysRevD. And in this plot, it's just one of the results. If you go to the paper, it summarizes the different exclusion regions. In this plot, just so you know, the exclusion region that's most relevant is the one that's over here. This red line corresponds to the 90%, the 99% exclusion region. So stuff over here on the right tends to be excluded with some confidence by our search. We did not detect any gravitational waves. But on the plot, this is parameterized by three numbers. The first one is the mass per unit length of the string itself, and this is essentially free. Okay? So in this plot, it goes from 10 to the minus 12. G mu goes from 10 to the minus 12 to 10 to the minus 4. The second thing is a proportionality factor, which relates essentially the mass per unit length, the time of formation of the loops initially, and their initial length scale. Okay? There's a dimensionless parameter epsilon, which relates all of those numbers. So the initial formation length of the cosmic strings will be cosmic string loops will be epsilon times a factor that we know to be about 50 times g mu times the time at which they form in the early universe. And that's this parameter on the vertical axis. It's essentially unconstrained. It's got to be less than 1, but that's it. And then the third parameter, in the case of cosmic superstrings, is that there's a recombination probability. When you get intersection of cosmic strings, just standard cosmic strings, what happens is when they cross, they actually just automatically always interconnect and then can form subloops and so forth. In the case of the cosmic superstrings, the idea is that they may not actually, they may not reconnect every time they cross. And as a result, you actually have a dependence on what is the probability of reconnection. This plot is shown for a reconnection probability of 10 to the minus 3. And as you can see, a small portion of the parameter space is excluded by the non-detection of gravitational waves from these types of sources in the universe. Yeah, I should have been 100% sure on that. I think this is the 90%. And this is a 95, I think. The red line is a 95. I think. I should have checked up before I put it up. I'm going to skip through this thing. The next one, this is also, this also may have a little bit of interest because it goes back to the same question about the early universe in the end and also cosmic strings again. Another source of gravitational waves could be a stochastic background of gravitational waves generated in the early universe, very much like the cosmic microwave background that we all know and love for the constraints and other things that it gives us on the formation and of structure in the early universe. The gravitational waves from the early universe itself, in principle, we can see way, way back, way before the time of inflation, and way back beyond the time of the cosmic microwave background, which is around 200 or 400,000 years. The image of the sky is going to look very similar to this. It's just a cartoon of it. Basically, we don't actually have very good pointing resolution with gravitational wave detectors, but so you'll actually get this sort of map of the sky with stochastic background gravitational waves coming in from all directions. The thing that we measure, and we can actually put a bound on it, is the energy density in gravitational waves per unit logarithmic frequency compared to the critical density. So that's the thing that we can bound. And the most recent result that we have is based on the LIGO S5 data and is summarized in these two plots. So this is going to take me a couple of moments to go through, but it's almost my last point. So let me first start with this one, which is the first easy one to understand. We've actually already looked at something like the one on the right. This is frequency along the horizontal axis. It goes up to 10 to the 10 hertz down here. 1 hertz is here, and 10 to the minus 18 hertz is here. There is a result from LIGO plotted on this plot. It's hidden way, 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 way up here, just right in here. It's this little black point where it says LIGO S5. And that is the energy density, the constraint that we were able to place by non-detection, yet again, sorry, but it continues to be a theme, non-detection of gravitational waves in roughly the 100 hertz band. We were able to constrain omega for gravitational waves to be somewhere in here around a few times 10 to the minus 6. For us, this was a milestone. It's not really a huge milestone, but it is a milestone because we finally actually beat the Big Bang nucleosynthesis bound, which is indicated by the red line up the top here. So we actually have started now to go into a space where we actually start to go below some of the previous observations. For the record, there's a few other numbers shown. The advanced LIGO, where we hope to be able to put constraints if we don't see stochastic gravitational waves, is down here. Cosmic strings, the spectrum from cosmic strings we might expect would look something like this. And so in principle, it makes it detectable with certain parameters by the advanced LIGO detectors. And there's a bunch of other curves here which actually show different limits based on different observations. Once again, on the right, one of the things we like to do nowadays, because we like to think that we're actually doing something useful, is we once again plot the mass per unit length of our cosmic string, that dimensionless parameter epsilon up here, and the recombination probability over is 10 to the minus 3, rather, for this plot. The exclusion region, based on the stochastic gravitational waves, is given by the region to the right. It's, again, the 90% exclusion region here in this particular plot. This lightly shaded area is the S5 result, so everything to the right is excluded. The key point is actually that all of these other curves correspond to other exclusions. This one is Big Bang nucleosynthesis and rules out everything up to the top right. This one here is actually pulsar timing, so it's the timing delays on pulsars. There is the cosmic microwave background. This one is the pulsar timing one, pardon me. And the exclusion is downwards on that, CMB is the vertical one, exactly, yeah. And then you've also got this is the burst exclusion region in this particular case. That was the one from the previous search. And this here is from a postulate from Planck. So we're beginning to do some things. We tend to get into regions where you can't probe these parameters for a few cases, but it is somewhat limited still at this point. Now let me finish by just giving you just the very briefest of overviews of where we are and where we hope to go next. The current activities are what we call the sixth science run. And during this run, we're operating three instruments simultaneously, the two LIGO detectors, and a detector in Europe. It's in Italy. It's the Virgo detector. It's a French-Italian collaboration. We're operating all three of them. The good news for us in that is that the baseline of the three detectors allows us to localize the source on the sky in principle. And here on the left is a simulation which shows how we'd reconstruct position from a tentative source, this one being a compact binary, just located somewhere on the sky. We get these contours here. This one is basically a 90% contour in the red and about a 60% contour in the yellow. They're pretty big compared to standard astronomical numbers. We actually have 10 to 100 square degrees in these areas. So they're actually very, very big areas when we localize them. Nevertheless, what we're actually hoping to do is to, I'm just going to stick this in here. What we're hoping to do in S6 is to actually start to take a look at some of our low likelihood, so things that are kind of not really things that we consider to be very likely to be gravitational wave triggers in our data. And we want to actually just localize them on the sky and follow them up with electromagnetic observations. So we've got a number of collaborations with SWIFT, with ROTSI. There's also these other telescopes are actually, this is the Keck telescope in Hawaii. This is the LIGO Synoptic Survey Telescope. But we also have a number of other telescopes that we're collaborating with to attempt to follow up some of our triggers. Even though we don't think they're gravitational waves, perhaps if we can actually catch some form of electromagnetic counterpart, it would increase our confidence that they might be gravitational waves. And I'm going to finish now with stuff that we've touched on multiple times. multiple times through the talk, which is, where are we going? So it's 2009 now. The S6 science run is going to continue until next year. We hope to be able to continue all the way to August. It may go later, but at that point, we'll have to turn off, and the LIGO instruments are going to go into a rebuild mode. They're basically going to strip out all the old instrumentation and put in a bunch of new instrumentation that we call advanced LIGO. When we do that, we're going to go through a commissioning phase, or actually a construction phase more likely, that will last until about 2014 to 2015, at which point we'll have acceptance of these advanced instruments. The sensitivity of those advanced instruments is expected to be about 10 times that of initial LIGO. This is where, again, the 1 over R is important. Okay, that means that the same type of source 10 times further away will actually be detectable by us. And it means, as a result, that we expect to have 1,000 times as many sources as we do at the present time. And this is what really, this increase in range by a factor of 10 gives us an accessible volume of the universe that's 1,000 times bigger. And that is what brings us into this regime where we have an expectation of 40 binary neutron stars per year detectable by LIGO. This cartoon simply demonstrates the number of galaxies within that region. The inner region in here is the initial LIGO sensitivity. Virgo cluster is right in here. And then this is the advanced LIGO, this sort of opaque colored sphere as you come out. And you get a lot of major clusters when you get out to that distance. So that's where I'm going to end. And thank you for your attention.
Questions. Thank you. That was really an excellent talk. I'm going to ask you for a moment and go first to the students, the science students.
I'm a student.
Anybody from the students want to ask a question? Yeah.
If you haven't been actually detecting anything, how do you know that your lack of detection is a negative, like a sign that's not there and not that you're detecting incorrectly?
Yeah. That's a good question. Right now, the real problem is that our expected rates are so low that we don't think we should have detected anything yet. So as a result, trying to actually draw a conclusion that something's wrong with either our detector or our theory is a bit early. If we get to advanced LIGO, and we're expecting, one a week, then at that point, I think it's reasonable to start asking questions about what's going wrong if we don't see them. And the first thing is, does your instrument work? Well, it's pretty basic principle to make it work. But on the other hand, there are some complications. Well, that was good. On the other hand, there are some complications. But realistically, I would say we check that, but it probably won't be that's going wrong. Then the next thing is, you might say, oh, cool, we've just shown that gravitational wave theory, GR is not right. Gravitational waves are not right. That's less likely. It's much more likely that the problem is really going to come back to the fact that the astrophysics, which was asked about earlier, that leads us to know what these rates are, which is fine. And that we really are in this, there's far fewer of these things occurring in the universe than we expected.
So. Okay, well, let me go, since Neil was first.
I don't know.
Okay, go ahead.
So, one issue when you're trying to pull the signal out of the noise, you have to sort of know what the signal looks like ahead of time. So, if there's an error in the wave function from the in spiral, what you think it might be, that's also an issue as well. Is that, how does that sort of plug into your limit?
So we have some constraints on that, right? Not very many, admittedly, but we have some. And so the first thing is that in terms of just assuming GR is correct, and therefore you're calculating these waveforms for the compact binaries correctly, in principle, there are controllable errors associated with the approximation schemes we're using. So what we do in order to check that we're not being fooled by our ability to detect is to use the waveforms at different levels of approximation. So that just double checks for us. And what we do is we actually use the same detection technique, but we vary the type of simulated signal we put into our data to check that we're able to detect it. So that checks that one. But then there are other things that we may not know. The theory may not be right. There are phases where numerical relativity is needed, and the waveforms have only just become available. We need to understand those. And again, all we do in those cases is we try to parameterize what the expected modifications to the waveforms are, and then fake simulations that actually fake that to double check that we still detect things. And so far, it's a very robust method, it turns out. The main reason is that when we search for compact binaries, we don't just look for one waveform. We look for, at the moment, 10,000, and they're all just ever so slightly different mass parameters. And so as a result, once you're doing that, you tend to span a fairly wide space of signals, no matter what.
Okay, could you give us an idea what the raw data looks like at this point?
Yes, let me see if I can actually. Let me see if I can. bit. I'm afraid I don't have one very easy to hand, but let me just open a bunch of stuff here. So I'm gonna show you two things. First one here is a piece of data which actually has a simulated waveform in it. It's not going to get any bigger. This is about 10 seconds of data. We measure H. We actually really measure H. Okay, so that's what this is. Now, we have a bunch of auxiliary information that we measure as well. But this is about 10 seconds. Yeah, the vertical axis in this case is basically counts. It's really a renormalized strain that we use. It really is not important what the actual strain number is. If you have to be careful as well because of the color of the noise. Low frequency stuff, if you don't wipe that out, will dominate completely. So you'll actually get some problems. But this is a clean piece of data. So this is what we'd like to see most of the time if we could. However, if we go down and take a look at something else. This was our loudest and most significant event in the very first science run that we did. This actually appears in print as the largest, most significant thing. As you can see, it really does not look like something that's just a very nice, simple waveform coming from something that's just sweeping through the band and sweeping upwards in frequency. It's got multiple peaks, got a lot of structure in it. Turns out that this actually was a photodiode saturation. We didn't know about it in advance of the search. We didn't realize that we needed to veto it. And as a result, we learned something from our search, which was to veto such things. So they're just two examples. Bottom line is that there's a full spectrum of things. We have an underlying sort of Gaussian noise, but then we just have a zoo of different types of signals that show up from all the control loops, from the laser jitter, from all kinds of stuff like that. Yes.
Yeah, as if you consider something like a pulsar, where you have a line propeller, which is supposed to have some non-zero quadrupole moment, which is emitting continuously, you should get an improvement in the signal-to-noise ratio.
Yes. So one of the searches that I skipped, and I'm not going to belabor it now because people will want to go, but one of the searches I skipped is the search for gravitational waves from pulsars. This is the S5. This is one of the S5 results for known pulsars that are in the frequency band that LIGO is sensitive to. And the blue stars correspond to our upper limiting strain that we actually can impose. This back gray background corresponds essentially to our noise limit. It's essentially the noise curve of the instrument. You can see it follow the same shape. In this case, it turns out there's one interesting observation, which is actually for the Krapp pulsar, which I think is this one over here. Be careful, the Krapp may not be on this plot. Actually, Krapp's not on this plot. Krapp pulsar is about 60 hertz, and our observation for it has placed an upper limit on the ellipticity, how much like a Canadian football it is. to about 1 part in 10 to the 4. The thing is, you can estimate that as well from the observed spin down of the pulsar. And you can sort of suppose all of the spin downs caused by gravitational waves, then the ellipticity would actually be 10 to the minus 3. So in principle, this is yet another win. But realistically, 10 to the minus 3 is two orders of magnitude above where you'd expect it to be at the very best.
So your sensitivity is in the audible range. People were talking about actually playing this for people to listen to. Is that taking place?
Yeah, we actually we do that. I actually do have a couple of things here. Unfortunately, I really wanted to actually play that particular dot photodiode overflow, but I couldn't find the data to make the plot or make the sound. I have a few sounds that we play from time to time. We do tend to do it. In actual fact, one of the things we do when we get our candidates that come out the end of our search analysis pipelines, we get these things that are meant to be the most likely things to be gravitational waves. None of them have been so far. Often what we'll do is we'll generate a snippet of sound and actually listen to it. And of course, you'll get it from multiple instruments, audio range, you get to hear this stuff going on. The other thing is some people, in terms of characterizing the data, have taken to taking a day's worth of data, putting it on their iPod, and listening to it on the way home to work. And then they come in, and if they're really, really good experimentalists, they come in and they fix something for us. That's brilliant.
Also, you mentioned something about the mass of a graviton being affected.
Yeah.
Can you say how that would work?
Essentially what happens is if it's a massive graviton, there'll be a dispersion measure, a dispersion across the frequency range. With the compact binaries, the waveform from the compact binary will sweep upwards in frequency, as I mentioned a little while ago. Let's see if we can actually find one here. So that's what the waveform will look like in terms of strain on the vertical axis and time on the horizontal axis. It oscillates at low frequency initially because they're far apart. As they get closer together, it goes faster and faster. The point is that the evolution in time of the frequency evolution is dictated by GR. If there's a dispersion relation, then you'll actually get a slight delay at the different frequencies, and so you can actually principle for constraints. If it's not correlated with various parameters in the theory. It turns out you actually can put some constraints. No, I don't have that on the tip of my tongue. The paper to look for is a paper by Cliff Will. He compared it to all of the different limits that already exist.
Okay, maybe one more question?
People sometimes talk about using gravitational wave astronomy to see things that are invisible for various reasons to like a big extent. For example, looking at things behind the big oblique wall of the recombination, or like looking at things, I suppose, inside various regions. So like, can you give examples of those, or like converting?
Well, I think the best example is finding black holes. So, you know, black holes, you know the old story of how to detect them, right? You know, it's basically that what you need something bright going around the black hole. You see the motion of the bright object with nothing else, and therefore you infer the presence of the black hole. In the context of gravitational waves, the waves from a pair of black holes, imagine there could be a black hole with a mass of one solar mass and a black hole of five solar masses. The gravitational waves from something that is two black holes with five solar masses and one solar mass will be the same as the gravitational wave from a neutron star and a black hole with five solar masses. And so the thing is, even though that pair of black holes would essentially be invisible to us in other mechanisms, you now can see it or hear it, at least, in terms of the waves.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. That was a great talk.